This is when the meditation starts to bite. And the questions start to increase. Okay, so are you all comfortable? Ready for this evening's questions? And again, it's great to put these questions up, even if you come to one of the interviews and I say something profound you want to share with other people. Then ask the question again so it can all be shared. Here's question number one today. Dear Ajahn, do one meditate for others? If yes, please advise how to do it. Many thanks. Soon, before you know it, will be the end of the retreat. And you have to go back to the people you live with. If you meditate well, if you gain some peace and some wisdom, then you won't give such a hard time to the people you live with. You will find that if you are peaceful, if you are wise, if you are kind, that's a wonderful gift you can give to other people. And you don't need to actually to even spread metta deliberately. It's for the sake of other beings that you get your act together, that you become peaceful, kind, wise, mindful, so you don't say these awful things you regret later on. So when you're meditating, when you even meditate for the sake of enlightenment, for the sake of peace, you think you're being selfish. The fact is that when you go out of here, everything which you learn, everything which you develop in a retreat like this, will be for the benefit of all sentient beings. Even if you meditate, even the mosquitoes who come in here, you're meditating for them. Because if you learn how to let go of the body, you don't swap them anymore. So learning this way of meditation is for the happiness and well-being of all mosquitoes. Even the cockroaches. It's for the benefit of all cockroaches as well. Because when you're peaceful and kind, you don't mind them crawling over you at night. Like they did last night when I was going to sleep. Actually, I did mind. I woke up. But never mind. As you meditate deeper and deeper, it is naturally, it affects other people. And there's heaps of stories about this. There's a story about this man who always wanted to go on a meditation retreat. But his wife said, no, you can't. Because the retreats were on the weekend. And a weekend in Australia is the only time you have to do the shopping, to take the children to the sports, to do the little jobs around the house, to do the washing, to do the gardening. There's so much to do on the weekend. His wife said, you can't leave me to do that all by myself. No, you can't go. Now this is an important lesson in getting your own way. You don't argue. You're just persistent, that's all. He just carried on every time it's a weekend retreat. Darling, can I go? There's a retreat on. No, you can't go. There's a washing. The kids have got sports. You've got to take the daughter to a party this weekend. You've got to clean out the attic. You've got to fix up the lawnmower. There's too much to be done. No, you can't go. Week after week, whenever there's a retreat, he kept on asking. And in the end, the wife got so frustrated. Okay, you go on your retreat and leave me to the housework, the washing, the cleaning and everything else. So he went. After a while, people just give in. And when he came back from the retreat, she couldn't believe the change in her husband. He was just so soft, so kind, so sensitive. She was so pleased. It was worth doing all the housework by herself for a weekend to get a husband like that. So when it came to the next retreat, this is a true story, he never needed to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. Now you can see the moral of that story is that when you meditate, you may think it's for yourself. You may think it's getting your own act together, for your own peace, for your own joy, for your own happiness, for your own wisdom. But you are not separated from the people you live with, the people you work with, even the people you see on the street. They're all affected by you. So you think this is selfish, just taking time out. But it's important for the people who have to put up with you. So for the sake of all the people who have to endure you, you come to this retreat to make their life much better. So you are doing meditation for others, and you're also doing meditation for yourself as well. There is no difference between yourself and others. When you get the self out of the way, anatta, non-self, as you, so others. As others, so you. And the best thing you can do for others, the kindest thing you can do for others, the most compassionate thing you can do for others, is to be peaceful and to be kind. And that's the greatest gift. In fact, the greatest gift is Nibbana itself. They've got this beautiful phrase in the Ratana Sutta, one of the famous sutras of the Buddha, which we recite often. The Buddha became enlightened. He said, Nibbana Gamaya, Paramang Hitaya. He went to Nibbana, to extinction, for the ultimate benefit of other people. That's the greatest gift he could give to others, to disappear, to show by example what's possible. And so every now and again we get some people say, oh, there's two types of Buddhism. There is the Mahayana, which is a compassionate, which puts off their enlightenment out of concern for other beings, and is these Theravadins, who are just concerned about their own enlightenment and don't give a damn about others. We're just getting out of here and just, you know, I'm all right, Jack, goodbye everybody. But that is just a simplistic way of looking at it. Because you're on this retreat all by yourself. And sometimes you think, what am I doing for other people? You're doing heaps for other people. Just your peace and your kindness, your softness, you'll take out from here. And this will just be like the, what is it, that chicken virus going around. This is not the chicken virus, this is Samadhi virus. And when you go back to Terengganu, to Penang, to Singapore, to England, to London, to US, and all the other places you came from, I'll be infecting you with this peace virus. And when you go out, that virus will spread to other people who are in close contact with you, and will have an epidemic of peace and kindness and letting go and relaxation and fun and just enjoying yourself and just being at peace and not controlling. It's even worse than SARS. Even worse than the chicken, what's it called, the chicken virus? Bird flu, yes, this is not bird flu. This is defilements flu, because they fly away and you've got none left at all. And this is the virus you respect. So what you do affects other people. That's why you're never meditating for yourself. You're never meditating just for others. You're meditating for us, for the world. And you can find that out. If you meditate well, you can help so many other people. Look at me. Look at Ajahn Chah. Look at the Buddha, what he did just by sitting under a Bodhi tree. So-called being selfish. It's the greatest gift you can give to others. The peace of your own heart. If you haven't got any peace within, what do you give to others? All your psychoses. All your dysfunctional words and actions. You just give trouble, that's all. So, meditate well, and it'll be the greatest gift you can give to your partner when you go home. Here, darling, is my peace. We call it giving her a piece of your mind. So, that is meditating for others. Dear Ajahn, any questions about that before I go on to the next one? There is no difference, actually. It was just us. Dear Ajahn, can you advise whether focusing attention on the lip or of the nose or the upper lip makes the mind more subtle and sensitive, or should one just focus on the breath generally and let things happen of their own accord? I strenuously deny having had advice on this matter in the past and emphatically state that I have no previous knowledge of this subject. John Howard. That's what it's written on here, John Howard. I never realised the Prime Minister of Australia was on this retreat, incognito. Very, very good. But the point of the matter is, Australians will get that joke, but maybe others won't. I think it was the Children Overboard he started this, when he said that I strenuously deny having had advice on this matter in the past and emphatically state that I have no previous knowledge of this subject. Children Overboard, I think the Weapons of Mass Destruction and all sorts of other things. That's what he kept on saying. But that's very good. Someone really is smart there. But anyway, when it comes to where you you should watch the breath. When I started meditating, I was told to watch it at the tip of the nose. And, you know, or in the lip, or somewhere around here somewhere. The trouble was, I used to suffer from hay fever. And so my nose was blocked. And I couldn't feel anything there. You know why? There's no air going in and out. Nose blocked. Complete waste of time. And then I was so relieved that later on, when the Mahasi Sayadaw method came up, you could watch it at the abdomen. So I started watching it there. But the trouble is, when I became a monk and started watching it there, it was far too close to the stomach, especially as a young monk in the evening meditating. Because when you started putting your attention down there, you didn't see the belly rising. You saw your empty stomach, and you got very hungry. So that didn't work either. So we don't advise belly meditation on retreats, especially for people who are not used to not eating in the evening. Because as soon as you go down there and go, oh, I need something in my stomach. Now the point of the matter is, it does not matter where you watch the breath. And there's another problem with actually watching at the tip of the nose. It's too strong a focus, and people force their mind. It's one of the reasons why they get this samadhi headache business. And one of the reasons people very often who focus on the tip of the nose get a headache or tension across their brows. And somebody pointed out why it's happening. I have to take my glasses off so you can see this. Because even though you have your eyes closed, when you focus on here, so automatically your eyes focus on there as well. And you start going cross-eyed. And if when people were, it's true, if when people were focusing on the tip of their nose, if I could just open their eyes and see what they were doing, they would be cross-eyed. And imagine doing that for half an hour or an hour. No wonder you get headaches and tension across here. The point is that you're not really focusing, feeling. You're trying to just look at it. It's just nature. It's psychology. That's just what we do. And the point of the matter is that sometimes you can watch the tip of the nose. You just can't find your breath. And the reason is because it's not there. I'm sure that this weekend, some people are going to go to Nolamara, our city centre, because they want to hear a talk from Ajahn Brahm. They go there. He's not there. And they get disappointed. They can't find me anywhere in Nolamara. And they might even go to Serpentine. They look for me there. I'm not there either. You know why? Because I'm here. In the same way, in this simile, it's like you look for the breath in the nose. Where's the breath? I can't find the breath. It's not in the nose. So you go and look for it in the stomach or the tummy. You can't find it there either. You know why you can't find it? It's not there. It's somewhere else. It makes it obvious that you look for the breath where it is. If you want to find Ajahn Brahm, you've got to come to the retreat centre in North Perth. That's what you are as well. You look for the breath where it is. Now this method just hit me years ago. Instead of watching at the tip of the nose, instead of watching at the belly, I'd close my eyes and say, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Yeah, I know that one. Breathing in or breathing out, it could have been. How do I know? And there was some sensation, some feeling, somewhere in my body. Sometimes it was at the tip of the nose, sometimes in the belly. Often it was somewhere else. I didn't care where it was located, as long as there's a feeling somewhere inside me which told me I was breathing in, or it told me I was breathing out. I had something to watch. And I realized when I watched the feeling of the breath, rather than the location of the breath, I could always actually find the breath at all times. But when I watched for a place, sometimes I couldn't see it, for the one reason it wasn't there. So people who try and watch the breath at the tip of the nose, sometimes you get very frustrated because you can't find it. Sometimes you can see the out-breath, but you can't find the in-breath. Or the other way around. You can see the in-breath, but you can't find the out-breath. And it comes, oh, what's going on? Because sometimes the in-breath's there, but the out-breath is somewhere else. So you shouldn't watch the breath where it should be or where it's supposed to be. In the same way, you shouldn't go and find Ajahn Brahm where he should be, in Nolamara, where he's supposed to be. You look for him where he is. You look for the breath where it is. So once I figured that one out, it made the breath meditation so much easier. And you could always watch the breath. And every time I lost the breath, am I breathing in, am I breathing out, straight away a feeling would come up. There it is again. You carry on watching it. You watch the feeling of the breath. That which tells you whether you're breathing in or it tells you whether you're breathing out. The feeling, the sensation which says you're in the beginning of an in-breath, the middle of an in-breath, or somewhere else on that whole journey of breath. That's all you need to watch. And it had an extra advantage, which I only figured out many years later. When I stopped watching the body and instead watched the breath, the body disappeared much sooner. When I watched the tip of the nose, the door was open for every other bodily sensation. Insects landing on you, aches and pains. When I watched the belly, it was the same. Other bodily sensations, in particular hunger, was open to me. When I just watched the feeling of the breath, and I wasn't concerned about the body at all, the body completely disappeared very quickly. I couldn't feel the body anymore, because I was not paying any attention to it. Instead, I was paying attention to the feeling of the breath, not to the body. And of course, it made sense afterwards, because the Buddha never taught nose meditation. He never taught belly meditation. The Buddha taught breath meditation. It's obvious. He never told you to watch your nose. He never told you to watch your belly. He told you to watch your breath. There's many objects of meditation, but nose meditation or belly meditation is not one of them. There's not two of them, sorry. So you can understand that you don't watch the breath anywhere. You just watch the feeling of the breath. And I call it disembodied breath meditation. Take away the bodily part, and you just watch the feeling of the breath, the sensation of it. And you haven't got a clue where it is. And you don't care where it is. You don't really, that's not part of your perception. You just know the breath is going in. You know it's going out. That's enough. Simplifies things. And it also means you're many steps ahead on the path of deep meditation. So, there you go, Mr. Howard. Now you know how to meditate. Any questions on that? Okay, very good. There's one thing I should say, maybe. I mentioned this in an interview. As you're watching the breath, you can know it going in, you can know it going out. You disembodied it. After a while, it becomes really smooth, just breathing in, breathing out. And then it comes a time where you don't know. The in-breath and the out-breath become the same. So you can't distinguish between an in-breath and an out-breath, between the beginning or the end of a breath. It's just breath happening, that's all. And they've got a simile for this in one of the commentaries called the Visuddhimagga. And the simile is of a carpenter sawing a piece of wood. And that carpenter obviously focuses their attention on where the saw meets the wood. And when they start sawing the piece of wood, their focus is quite wide. They can see the handle of the saw, the whole blade of the saw, up to its tip, and a lot of the wood as well. But as they focus in, after a while they can't see the handle or the tip of the saw. They can only see a portion of the wood. As they focus more and more, all they can see is just one tooth blade of the saw and just the tiny area where it's cutting the wood. It's called focusing. And they don't know whether that tooth blade is at the beginning of the saw or the end of the saw. They can't see where it is because they've got no reference point. All they can see is just one tooth blade. This is what happens when we meditate. We've got no reference point to know whether it's the beginning of an in-breath or the end of the in-breath, or even an out-breath. All we see is just one moment of breath. Like the carpenter just sees one tooth of the saw. And so there comes a time where you're watching the breath go in and out, the inness and the outness disappear. Beginningness, middleness, endness, all those attributes just vanish. You just know breath. You're simplifying your meditation object. And it becomes so smooth and changeless that soon it disappears. And when the breath disappears, that's when you get into nice meditation subjects. But that comes later. Stay tuned to another episode of Jhana, and we'll give you the next instruction, but just get that so far. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please briefly explain again the antidotes to the five hindrances? I was experienced sloth and torpor during your discourse, sleepy, grumpy, and remorseful. Well done for having sloth and torpor. I really praise people who have sloth and torpor. Because there's an old story about sloth and torpor, which I never mentioned this morning. And it's the story of the Buddha with Ananda walking into the forest. When he just got a little way into the forest, on the edge of a forest, he saw this monk meditating. And this monk was sitting absolutely straight, with the perfect posture, silent and still in his meditation, just like you'd expect a good meditator would be. And the Buddha took one look at him and turned around to Ananda and said, I'm worried about him. Sure enough, a few days later, he disrobed and got married. Later on that morning, the Buddha went deep into the forest, and there in the middle of the forest, he saw another monk sitting in meditation, nodding this way, nodding that way, a prey to sloth and torpor. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about him. And a couple of days later, he was fully enlightened. I love that story. Because it's not what you expect. You think the one sitting really, really straight is a good meditator. But the Buddha realized, understood that that was a control freak monk. I'm going to sit absolutely straight. Especially us monks, because we're facing all of you. And we've got our reputation to keep, haven't we, Venerable Sanchidhi? Haven't we, Venerable? Ah, forget about it. If you want to nod for your hearts, just go for it. But the point was, the control freak, and some of you are control freaks as well, it sits so straight, because you've got your reputation, or whatever else, your ego. So a person who sits that straight, just out of control, you won't be able to maintain that all that long. I've known some monks like that. They've got no happiness in their meditation. No happiness in their meditation means no happiness in monastic life. After a while, they just leave. What's the point? The Buddha saw that. The monk was just controlling, forcing, holding his body through willpower. You can't last that long. That 2 days, he described. But the other monk was letting go. He was being at peace. Even when the Buddha was around, he wasn't so sort of proud to sort of try and put on a show. He was letting go. It was only a matter of time. From making peace with the sloth and torpor disappeared. And it was left with real peace. And after that real peace, jhanas, enlightenment, everything happened. So of all those hindrances, sloth and torpor is the one you have to be least worried about. Even the Buddha's, one of his two chief disciples, Mahamoggallana, when he started meditating, he too was a nodder. And in a few days, he became fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. So the one who asked this question, there's many days left, I expect you by the end of this retreat to be fully enlightened with many psychic powers. So, basically the antidote to these things, the antidote to all of these things is just to be peaceful with them. Let them be. Allow them into your life instead of trying to control them and get rid of them. When you're at peace with things, you're making peace in the moment. And peace is just like a brick you lay on the foundation of the great edifice called jhanas, which leads to the city called Nibbana. They're built out of bricks of peace. And every time that you make peace with this moment, another brick is being laid in your house. Another brick of peace. And after a while, if you make peace with every moment, it doesn't matter what those moments are, what you're experiencing, soon you'll have so much peace that all you have is peace. You make peace. And in that peace comes energy and clarity. That's where mindfulness comes from. So, if you've got sensory desire, like I said I had at that six rains retreat, and I try to stop it, but in the end, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., right, you can think whatever you want. I made peace with it. I let it go. And all the sensory desire stopped. Ill will. Don't try and conquer your enemies. That's just like being like Mr. Bush. To spread freedom through war. Big joke. Don't you try to do that, to conquer your enemies. You just make more enemies that way. So, free yourself from anger. Allowing it to be. So when you make peace with ill will, you make a truce. You don't try and conquer the enemies. You learn how to, what's it, to peacefully coexist with things you don't like. With the person sitting next to you. With your crazy mind states. With your aching body. With the heat, with the cold. Peacefully coexist with the stupid jokes from Ajahn Brahm. Then when you peacefully exist with these things, there's no problem anymore. You've overcome ill will. Sloth and torpor, you make peace with sloth and torpor. It just goes by itself. Restlessness. Stop feeding restlessness with controlling. You make peace with it. Doubt. Make peace with it. Make peace with everything. A fundamental antidote to all these things. Sometimes they say, ill will, do loving kindness. But loving kindness is another word for peace. Ill will, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. Crazy mind, the door of my heart's open to you. Come in. Sloth and torpor, the door of my heart is open to you. Come in. This is loving kindness. It works for everything. Loving kindness, letting go, making peace, all the same thing. Otherwise, you can give dana. That overcomes all the hindrances. You know what I mean? I don't mean giving donations. Just give yourself the moment. When I'm giving myself complete to this moment, I don't expect anything back in return. That's true giving, true generosity. So I'm giving myself to this meditation retreat, and I do not expect anything back. This is my dana to the Buddha, to sit here for 9 days not expecting anything. Can you do that? Or are you going to expect something? If you're expecting it, it's not dana, it is business. I will do this meditation retreat if I get something back in return. You give your investment, you want your returns. That is not dana. So what dana is another word for letting go. I'm going to give this hour to this meditation cushion. And I literally don't want anything back. I just want to give. Give my time, give my body, give my energy, give my mind to this moment. Take the whole lot. Mind, the whole lot. I give it all to you. That's what I mean by dana. Giving your life to this moment. If you can do that, all the hindrances disappear. Sensory desire, you don't want anything. You're just giving. Ill will, you're just giving. Sloth and torpor, you give yourself to sloth and torpor. Hey, sloth and torpor, I give myself to you. Take me away. Restlessness. You're not resisting. Because you're not resisting, you're not giving it any energy anymore. And doubt. Go on, doubt whatever you want to do. When you give up, this is called giving. It's called letting go. Giving up. Sometimes people try, you know, they try so hard. They try and try and try. And one day, usually the last day, I can't do this, they give up. And when they give up, it becomes so easy. All the meditations, they calm, beautiful meditations, jhana, everything. So instead of waiting to the last day, the last minute to give up now. Give up all hope of getting anywhere. And if you give up today, you can have all that fun for 7 days without having to sort of work so hard for it. So that's what you're supposed to do. But the antidotes to the five hindrances. Not the same as I said this morning, but the essence of what I said this morning. Any questions to that? Yeah.
So just to be clear, the control freak.
Yeah. Oh, the control freak suffers from everything. Ill will, sensory desire, doubt. Amazing how many control freaks have doubt about what they're doing. How many managers, how many politicians, prime ministers and presidents. They don't admit that they play with doubt. What am I doing? Is it right? How am I going to be judged? The more you control, the more doubt you have. The more you let go, the less doubt you have. And because they're controlling their plague of restlessness, and then just worn out, burnt out. That's where burnout comes from the control freaks of life. The more you control, the more you're going to burn out. When you give up and let go completely, there's no burnout anymore. There's an old saying, it's a traditional greeting, which abbots say to each other. They always say, how are your monks? Are they easy to teach? And about a year or two ago, 2 years I think it was, I went to Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. And now the abbot in charge there is a monk called Ajahn Liam. He took over from Ajahn Chah. He's been here a couple of times. He's a great monk. And I just had that greeting to him. It was just like a formality. How are your monks? Are they easy to control, easy to teach? And he said, yeah, they're really easy to teach. And usually he'd say, well, you know, so-so. He's always got a few scallywags hard to teach. So what do you mean, they're easy to teach? How do you do that? That's easy. If they want to do this, I let them do it. If they want to do that, I let them do it. They're easy to teach. But of course, I laughed my head off. But that guy knew what he was doing. He's an abbot of a famous monastery, and he was the control freak. And that's why he's just a sort of a laid-back, very easy, and very inspiring monk. The other story of this monk, which was really impressive, when my teacher, Ajahn Chah, died, I think they kept his body for about, well, quite a few months, it was even a year, I think, before they cremated him. And that gave Ajahn Liam, not only is a great monk, he's a great builder as well. And he decided he would build a crematorium for Ajahn Chah. And he built it in the shape of a stupa, like a memorial, with like a metal box inside with a big chimney going up. So the idea was actually be cremated inside the stupa where his ashes will eventually be enshrined. And he's a very, very practical monk. And he got some advice from engineers and he built this stupa with this big metal sort of container inside for the coffin. And this was a royal funeral. The King of Thailand was there, thousands of monks. And Ajahn Chah, this famous monk, it was his cremation, and when they lit the fire, the blooming thing exploded. And there's flames and fire all over the place. Now, if you were in charge, what would you do? Would you get worried and upset? What this monk did, he took one look, and he went back, because we did it about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. He took one look at what was going on, and went back to his hut and crashed out. He just went to sleep. And let other people look after it. And you think, wow, that guy is really, he really knows what irresponsibility and letting go. His teacher has just died, the whole thing has exploded, a real mess. And he can let go, say, I don't mind. And just let go and just go and take a rest. Now that is actually, we always talk about that, and that guy's got his act together. That's called letting go. It's easy to let go when things go well. But when everything goes wrong, it's a famous monk. They only get cremated once in life and all goes wrong. And he says, oh, well, never mind. And he just goes to have a rest. Many of you wouldn't be able to sleep for days afterwards. You need to sleep straight away. So that's actually how we let go of things. No control. You don't burn out. Okay, next. Is that your question? Yeah, sort of. Yeah, any other questions about that? Here we go, next question. Oh, this is great. I'm not sure if this can be read out. Ha ha ha. Now I've read that line, I have to read the rest. Okay. In case it might offend the people who are wearing it. If so, I'll ask you in my interview. No, because you're not offended by anything, are you? You've got such loving kindness and such peace, haven't you? Here we go. I am finding the smell of aftershave. or spray deodorant of some kind, and perfume, very distracting and unpleasant. How could I overcome this? Monks, are you wearing perfume? Okay, the answer is, it's not the deodorant which disturbs you, it's your disturbing the deodorant. Because always some smells come off people. It's very hot this time of the year. And it's, you know, very muggy because it's overcast. So look, you've got a choice. You either got the deodorant or you've got the natural smell. take your choice. And I think you probably prefer the aftershave. Or you may even get the beans, for those having beans in the morning, like me. But this is why I sit facing you, facing this way, not the other way. So the point is that you find it distracting. It's a strange thing that once you start getting into distraction, it becomes this huge thing and this huge problem. You can smell it everywhere. Once you get into sort of looking for problems. That's why you have to be very careful with a fault-finding mind. Because once you get into it, you sign a fault like someone's wearing aftershave. And somebody else is doing something else wrong. And someone else is doing something else wrong. Once you start feeding a fault-finding mind, there's no end of faults which you can find in everything. The teaching, the teachers, the place. There's too many of these warnings about a chatter all over the place. Or the crosses all over the place. There's just not enough good food. You can find fault with everything. Even the bed's too hard. So stop being a fault finder. It's deodorant. It's just a smell, that's all. Leave it alone and it disappears. After a while, you get used to it. If you don't get used to it, just get a couple of plugs and bung them up your nose or something. Because of everything. And go and get you one of these breathing apparatus so you come into this there's always this big bowl, fishbowl over your head and a couple of ventilators or whatever. No, because if it is a problem for you and you really feel it's a problem, just go and meditate in your room. Because there you can actually meditate outside where there's more air. But you're always going to get some sort of smells in this place. So I just want to leave that alone. If it's not deodorant, it's, mosquito repellent or sunscreen or just natural smells. That's just the way it is. So just people smell, that's all it is. So it's not the smell disturbing you, it's you disturbing the smell. That's very deep teaching. Dear Ajahn, can the thinking process coexist with present moment awareness? Is it true that when we are aware of our thinking, the thinking process ceases? Thank you, Ajahn. If you are aware of the thinking process when you began this question, you would not be able to finish it. Here's what happens. In just the rough form of present moment awareness, thinking can exist, coexist. But when you refine present moment awareness down, the thinking just gets forced out. You're so much in the present moment, the thinking doesn't have any time to arise and persist in your mind. I gave that simile yesterday, or this morning, or sometime, whatever. When you're in the present moment, you can't think when you said these things. But about the going to the concert, you imagine a classical concert. Maybe they're playing Brahms, my relation. Not really my relation. But you may be playing some sort of great piece of music. And when you are listening to that music, you cannot think. Because if you think, you miss too many notes. You have to really completely let go and listen to every moment to get the flow of the piece. Even when people are watching movies on the television, they're not thinking. Because the action is right there, and if you start thinking, you miss what's going to happen. So many aspects of life, thinking actually stops as we're in the moment to see what's going to happen next. or to listen to every piece of music. And if you really get into that present moment in meditation, you can't talk to yourself. The inner conversation ceases. Which is what happens with present moment awareness. We start with a coarse form of present moment awareness. We refine it and get it really sharp. And in that very sharp present moment awareness, where it's only one moment long, thought can't arise. Hasn't got space, hasn't got time. Because we've got to go to the next moment straight away. We haven't got the freedom to think. We're just totally immersed in this flow of events called now. So that's a wonderful way of stopping thinking. Just be more in the moment. And you become more like the listener than the talker. This is just a metaphor. You're either listening or you're talking. You can't be doing two at the same time. I once went past our monastery kitchen. Many years ago, there were six Thai ladies in there cooking the meal for the monks. I counted them, looked in the window. There were six of them in there. And I saw all six were talking at the same time. They were all talking. And I wondered who was doing the listening. And of course, no one was doing the listening. They're all busy doing the talking. It's a complete waste of time, isn't it? Because really, if you're going to talk, you need someone to listen to you. But sometimes people don't even worry about, is anyone listening? They just go talking. Six people talking, no one doing the listening. Absolutely crazy. But you do that quite often. So, you can't be talking and listening at the same time. You can't be thinking and being mindful at the same time. Being mindful is listening. Thinking is talking. I'm talking about here the inner talking. That's called thinking. The inner listening is called mindfulness. So you can understand why mindfulness and thinking cannot coexist. You're either mindful, experiencing things fully, or you're just talking about it. And the two are so different. And the best simile is the difference between the menu and the food. The menu talks about the food, but it's so different than the food. You have to eat the food to know what it really is. The menu and the food. Which would you rather eat? Tomorrow morning, should I just write out toast, muesli, orange juice, coffee, and give that to you? Would that satisfy you? If you just ate it, ate the piece of paper with all the names of your favorite foods on it. I could even write here, like noodles or this other stuff you have in, fried rice or just the Singaporean porridge. But that wouldn't satisfy you, would it? The words and the thing are very different. So why do we get lost in all this thinking business? If we do, we're not mindful. We're just talking to the world rather than listening to it. That's why we do present moment awareness. And we refine it until it's silence. And then we're mindful. And then we actually watch the breath. Just like the Buddha said in Anapanasati Sutta. First you establish mindfulness in front of you. That's what I mean by present moment awareness and silence. You're mindful. You're alert. You're receptive. Rather than reactive. Then you can watch the breath. And then it's so easy. You follow the instructions. Mindfulness first. And mindfulness means present moment awareness and silence. Okay. And when you're aware of your thinking, really listening to it, then of course you'll begin to become silent. Because you're not creating more words, more thoughts. So listen, and everything stops. You can't be talking inside and listening inside at the same time. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when one can keep attention on the breath for quite a while, silently in the present moment, how does one proceed from there on? I am just worried about the doer taking over. Thank you. Okay, you don't do anything. You just stay, enjoy just the present moment. So you're just sat in the present moment. What more do you want? This is a problem. I want the next stage, please. I want jhanas by the end of this retreat. I've come such a long way, all the way from Terengganu. I've come all the way from London. I've paid so much money and done so much. When I go home there, and they say, what did you do? And I say, slept. You think, oh, that's terrible. But I would say, that's a real meditator. You know what I call sleeping? Meditating flat out. So you don't tell you slept. You said you meditated flat out. Now the point is, we're always so goal orientated. We're all great achievers. That's why if you can spend this whole 9 days sleeping and not getting anywhere, sadhu sadhu, I'll bow to you. You've let go of this achievement thing and you've completely wasted your time. And it'd be a great achievement to waste your time and not feel guilty about it. You'll be that close to enlightenment. So we're all great achievers. We want things. We want it now. At least in the next 7 days, or however long you've got. Because one of you is leaving tomorrow. So, you've got to meditate all night. You've got to really try hard. Oh, don't. Remember Ananda's way he became enlightened? Ananda was meditating all night because the following morning he had this big meeting. 500 people were attending the meeting. 499 were fully enlightened except for one, and that was Ananda. Imagine. If I told you that all the other meditators in this room were fully enlightened today, and you were the odd one out. Ooh, that hurts. And you would try so hard. That's what Ananda did. And he tried so hard. And then when it came to dawn, he was nowhere. And that's when he gave up. And as soon as he gave up trying, that's when he became enlightened. Giving up, letting go, abandoning this self which always wants to achieve things. So, you don't proceed from there. Proceed means going on. You go in. You don't proceed, you in-seed. Or you, what's the word, you secede? Or, no, what's it? Secede means give up. So, you don't go on. You never look to the next moment. Looking to the next moment, looking for the next stage, looking for the next achievement is called excite. We look in, which is called insight. That's why this is insight meditation. We look into what we're doing now, into what we're feeling now, into what's happening now. We look into the moment, not onto the next moment. Looking onto the next moment is excite. That movement of the mind going out into the world. And it's called exciting. That's why it's called excite. It excites you. Insight. Going in, looking in. So you've got the present moment awareness and silence. Sorry. Deepen that experience. Go deeper into it. And you find in the very center of silence, there you'll find the breath. You don't have to go on to anything else. The breath comes from within, like a well, within a body of water. And there's a breath, it just comes from within, the silence. And then the next day, it's a beautiful breath. It's right within the ordinary breath. So you don't say, I've done the breath now, I can push that aside and get to the next one, the beautiful breath. No, I've done the beautiful breath now, when can I let that go and go on to the limiter? You don't do that, it's not going on, it's going in. You go into the beautiful breath. You make it firmer, stay longer and longer, go deeper into it, and as you go deeper into it, there the nimitta comes up from within the beautiful breath. Not from the left or the right, from within it. You don't let go of anything, you do let go of everything, you let go of the trying, but all these mental objects or objects of meditation, the next one is in the one you're in now. On the previous retreat I gave, which was in November, one of the meditators had gone to visit Russia and came back with a present for me, which he he gave me on the retreat. It was these Russian dolls. You've seen these Russian dolls. They've got this wooden doll. You take it out, and there's another one that looks exactly the same, only smaller inside. And the next one is inside that, and the next one is inside that. He gave it to me as a simile for what I was teaching. These are the stages of meditation, like Russian dolls. The next one is right within the one you've got now. So if you've got this Russian doll, you throw it away and think the next one's over here or over there. You're missing the point. The next stage of meditation is right in the one you have now. And it's an important thing to understand. So when you sit down and you first begin meditating, and my mind might be all over the place, sore, tired, dull, whatever, jhana's in the middle of that experience. You have jhana, but it's all covered up. So all you need to do is just to go into it. Go deeper into whatever you're experiencing now. And the whole experience opens and opens and opens and opens. And then right in the center comes the jhana. So it's centering, going in, never going on. Because if you start going on, the doer takes over. So he said, when one keeps attention on the breath for quite a while, silently in the present moment, how does one proceed from then on? You don't do anything, stay there, and from within that breath, the beautiful breath will come up when it is ready. Any questions on that one? Here's the next question. A friend of mine once remarked that during his 10 years of meditation, he has never seen any light at all, always in darkness. Should such a person continue to practice anapanasati, or should he switch to another object of meditation? Yeah, he should stop doing anapanasati and do breath meditation instead. Like I said this morning. It's true, just you call it a different name, you think, oh, this is a different method. And then he comes along to one of our Ajahn Brahm's retreats, thinks he's doing something different, and then finds he's doing exactly the same, and this time it works. So a lot of time, it's probably because he's heard about this light, and he wants the light. Whenever you want it, you never get it. So don't be ambitious, don't try and get things. This is good enough, this is good enough. And all these things come to you when you're not wanting them. Wanting is a defilement. It disturbs the mind. It's obvious when you understand the way of meditation, as soon as you want something, you're blocking the opportunity for it to arise. You're disturbing the mind. You're disturbing the world. It's not the meditation disturbs you. You disturb the meditation by messing it all up, by wanting things, by controlling it. Leave it alone. Let it go. And all these wonderful things just happen to you. You sit there and they just happen. And you can't get proud about it because you didn't do anything. It's not your fault. If you get into a jhana, you didn't do it. You know, I cannot get into jhana. I cannot get into jhana. I have to let me go first. When I go disappear, then these things happen. But you can't do it. So always remember that. There's no one in this room can get into jhana. You have to disappear first, and then jhana happens. It says in Visuddhimagga, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the one who enters. You disappear, and then these things happen. So since you let go, and you stop doing all this wanting business, which makes for the self, then these things happen. So you cannot achieve jhanas. You stop achieving, and the jhanas happen as a result. Understand? No, you don't. If you did, you just do it. You sort of understood. Anyway, apologies for having to request you to make an announcement. Please remind those who use the door at the end of Block B leading to the car park to lock it every time they use it. For security reasons, I hope they will all cooperate. It's unlocked most of the time. I'm tired of locking up after them. Please help. Okay, so those of you at the end of Block B, which is Block B, is that our block? That's not our block. Somebody else's block. Okay, remember to always keep the door locked so the defilements don't have a chance to get in. Those defilements, they're called like burglars. And those burglars, not only do they come in and steal all your possessions, if you don't keep the mind locked so the doer can't come in, the great burglar of your happiness, then the doer comes in and takes away all your peace and all your kindness. And it starts to make fault find, you get angry, you get upset about yourself and everybody else. And it's burgling your happiness. So don't allow the burglars of doing, controlling, into your mind. Keep the door locked. No doing. Just knowing. Okay? And it's true. I've locked that door so many times and someone keeps on opening it. You keep doing things. And I lock that door, say, don't do things, then you keep opening it again. So I'm getting fed up with closing that door just like this other person is. So please, follow instructions. Lock that door, both doors. Yeah, Joe, it's 45-minute meditation is enough, because that is when the body cries of pain. Which one is better? 2 45-minute meditations or 1 90-minute meditation, wherein you're fighting with the pain for the best part of the last 45 minutes? How do you stop the saliva from forming during meditation? Thank you. No, I asked only one question each, but never mind. If how long you should meditate? And the answer is only 1 moment. Stop thinking about time, 45 minutes or 90 minutes. Just meditate for 1 moment, just now. And let all the other moments just sort themselves out. Your only concern is with this moment called now. Just meditate now. Forget about time. You don't even look at the clock. So you don't know whether you've meditated for 45 minutes, an hour and a half, or 10 minutes, or 1 minute, or 2 days. You just meditate for the present moment, that's all. And then when it gets time to move, it could be through pain, or it could be just no pain in the body, but you just feel it's time to go. Then just get up. Change your posture. Or sometimes if you've got aches and pains in the body, but you feel you want to sit some more, then just gently, slowly, mindfully change your posture. Move your legs around. And then carry on. That's all you need to do. So you don't need to actually to, if you try and overcome pain, it's just more controlling business. And you'll find that sometimes you're tough and you can beat the pain down. Sometimes you can watch it and it disappears for a while. But when it comes back with even more force. So remember that pain is not a subject for meditation. If it was, the Buddha would have become enlightened in those 6 years when he was enduring immense pain. And what did the Buddha do once he became enlightened? His first teaching, those of you who have heard me say this before, it's a trick question. What was the Buddha's first teaching? Yeah, the middle way. You've heard me say this before. So many people say the Four Noble Truths, and that was wrong. The middle way was his first teaching. Not to actually to follow that part of asceticism, of enduring pain. Not to indulge in sensory pleasures. He found the middle way instead. But the extreme is actually trying to endure pain. Sometimes people think that they can beat down pain. That's not the way to enlightenment. Keep the body comfortable, which is why on this retreat we have these chairs. In some countries, meditation retreats, they don't allow chairs. They don't allow even cushions. They sit on broken glass, I'm sure. I don't think they do, I'm exaggerating again. But they think you've got to endure. They think that's the way to enlightenment. And you don't get anywhere that way. You get some toughness, that's all. You get some understanding of pain, but you don't get freedom from pain. So in this particular path of meditation we teach here, you go far deeper, more insight, getting deeper into the essence of things. This is the way the Buddha meditated. When he went under the Bodhi tree, he got some grass. He made it comfortable. Imagine sitting under the base of a fig tree, all knobbly roots. that must really cut into your buttocks, if you think about it. The Buddha never did that. He got a nice seat, first of all, a nice grass mat. This is actually, you can see the softness there, the gentleness, the kindness. So if the body's hurting, move it. Yeah. This is vipassana. But what you can do, you can just note it and just be with it for a while. But if it gets too strong, then move it. Sometimes it disappears, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes people go crazy when they try that method. They try so hard to overcome the pain. It's why that in vipassana retreats, you always actually take the photograph, the group photograph, at the end of the retreat. And everyone is just so happy and smiling after we pass in the retreat. Because they're going home, they don't have to endure all that pain anymore. So there's big smiles. A lot of people, if it's too much pain, they won't meditate anymore. I think, why are they doing it? They're so masochists. The point being that this path of Buddhism is a kind path, a gentle path, compassionate path. That's when you understand who the Buddha was. He's an incredibly compassionate being. He didn't go around punishing his monks when they misbehaved, but understand them and encourage them to do better next time. That force, that militariness, that aggression, which is very male, is absent in real Buddhism. So be kind to your body. Don't be sort of, you know, too soft and thinking, oh, it's too hot, I'm too tired, it's too cold. You know, have a little bit of inner strength. But don't force it too much. Okay. And how do you stop saliva from forming during meditation? Stop thinking about it. Now everybody think of the saliva in your throat. Now stop thinking about it. You can't do it. As soon as you become aware of it, you start to interfere with it. When you interfere with it, the saliva starts to come out greater than usual. So the only thing to do is just take your attention away, to think of something else. Just go back to the breath. Don't make a big deal about it, don't worry about it, and the saliva won't be a problem. So you're making a problem. You are, again, disturbing the saliva. The saliva is not disturbing you. In recent weeks, a number of people have asked me in what way is meditation from self-hypnosis and or psychological conditioning. Please clarify. Okay, meditation can use psychological conditioning, but the meditation transcends hypnosis and psychological conditioning to go to places where psychological conditioning and hypnosis can never reach. Remember that hypnosis and psychological conditioning is always giving orders, even though they're subtle ones. Now in meditation the mind gets so still, there's no orders are possible. They neither arise nor can they be made. You go into hugely deep states of mind. And number two, you are fully aware. In much of conditioning or hypnosis, you're either supposed to, I think, confuse the person or make them very, very dull. So they're not thinking straight, they're not really alert or aware. You've got to lessen the mindfulness for hypnosis to work. And once that mindfulness is lessened, then you can actually get people to do things. That's why all the TV adverts are the most inane and stupid things. To get below your guard. So your mindfulness is soft and only almost non-existent. And then they can have all these messages to buy this soap powder, which once you have your clothes washing this soap powder and make you irresistible to the opposite sex. It's stupid, but people definitely do that. This is why you buy it. So, this is the difference between hypnosis and meditation. Meditation goes hugely far deeper to places where hypnosis could never reach, where conditioning stops. Okay? Okay, the last question. Ajahn, do you think books on Buddhism meditation are a help or a hindrance to practice? That's a very difficult one for me to answer because I've written a couple. So if I say yes, they are a hindrance, it makes me a hypocrite. And if I say they are not a hindrance, I'm lying. How many books have you read, for goodness sake? How much more information do you need? So you've got enough information already. Sometimes we gather all this information and we think, if I get a bit more information, then I'll find out the truth. You have all the information, you just need to do it now. How many menus do you have to read before you actually order a meal, basically? So you have all the menus, you know what to do. So just do it. Don't think about it. Just let go. And that way that you don't need to read any more books. Isn't that a wonderful thing? All those books which are out there in the world. Think you have to read this one, then you have to read that one, then you have to read another one. Oh my goodness, it takes so much time reading books. Have you got enough time to read all those books? Instead, read the book of the mind. Open up the chapters. Chapter 1, present moment awareness. Chapter 2, silence. Chapter 3, the breath. Chapter 4, the beautiful breath. Chapter 5, the nimitta. And the chapter 6, the jhanas. So just read that book, and that's the best one you can read. But that's only if you really want on a fast path to nibbana. If you're going to read anything, you might as well read Dhamma books. So you can read if you want to. But make sure it's good books. And not read too much. Just enough. Ajahn Chah, just remember him saying, he said, reading and practice, it's the practice is like the main course of the meal. The reading is like the sweet which you get afterwards. But if you only eat the sweet, which is basically what I did today, I only had the ice cream. I shouldn't be talking about this. If you just eat the sweet and you don't eat the main course, you're going to become very sick. So if you just read the book, you do no practice, you become a very sick Buddhist. We call them coffee table Buddhists because they sit around coffee table talking about nibbana. And all from books and not really from any experience at all. So, but if you have your main course and make that the main part of your meal, your rice and curry or your potatoes or pasta, whatever it is you eat, and the sweet is just a little bit extra on the end, then that's just the right amount. So you can read, but not too much. Okay, any more questions about that? You all know that saying, that Zen monk? In my early years as a monk in England, not monk, so it was my early years as a Buddhist in England, we had a Japanese monk come on a teaching tour. And as he came on a teaching tour, he couldn't speak any words of English. He had to always have a translator to translate his Dhamma talks. But when he finished about 1 month of touring around giving talks on Buddhism, he managed to learn a couple of words, as you do. Just like Ajahn Chah, when he went to England once, he learned 2 words from England. That's the only English words he learned while he was over there. You know what words they were? Cup of tea. He came and said, did you learn any English? Is that cup of tea? But anyway, this Japanese monk learned a bit more than that. And we found out because at his last talk, it was in his Thai temple in London, and we asked him, what do you think of Buddhism in England? This was 30 years ago. No, actually 32 years ago. What do you think of Buddhism in England? And with great eloquence, he answered, books, books, books. Too many, too many, too many. Dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. And everybody knew his meaning. I mean, everyone in England at that time, they're just reading books about Buddhism. They're just doing no practice. So he said, too many books, put them all in the dustbin. Okay, any more questions before we finish off for tonight? Yes, go on.
What happened to Ajahn Chah's
Oh, just the other monks got in there. We hosed it down. A few of the monks, they were just really getting into it, got the hoses out and squashed all the fires. And there isn't still enough fire to burn the body. It's just like too hot. And the whole metal had actually melted the welds, and the flames were actually shooting out from the gaps. So as soon as it was hosed down and the fire died down to like really hot embers, it was enough to burn the corpse. But it didn't actually burn down the building. While that was all happening, just Ajahn Lien was just having a nice snooze. There is the teacher, he's the abbot of the monastery, it's his job, his fault. He didn't care. He just had to sleep. He was tired. That's really, really impressive. Okay, so that's enough for tonight. I've gone over time tonight. So it's 9:16. So hopefully you're all energized by this evening's session. Time to meditate, to enjoy the evening. What time do you usually go to bed when you're at home? Do you usually go to bed at 60 minutes past 9? Is this really your bedtime? So, if you've got energy, carry on meditating. You can walk outside into the night air. It's nice and cool and quiet. You can actually go and sit in your room if you want to, or sit in here and just see. And if once you get tired, you can just go to bed. And don't worry about what time you get up in the morning. You don't have to come to the chanting. You can do your own chanting, if you like, in your room. So, have a nice night. See you in the morning sometime. Good night.